Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. This is the half moon night, and we have about 1 week left of the winter retreat. We've all been gathered together, most of us here for the period of 3 months, the monastic community of nuns and monks, the resident lay community, the long-term lay residents of Amaravati, the winter retreat support team, a couple of dozen people have been helping out and lending a hand with great care and diligence to support this retreat time. All of us have gathered together to create an environment of Dhamma practice, whether it's for this 3 month period or whether it's for longer, for a year or many years, or whether you're just here for the evening, or come in from the local area once in a while just to join in with the routine. All of us contribute to this environment, this atmosphere of Dhamma practice. And in this, we're trying to sustain a situation wherein we can, as human beings, develop the best qualities that we can, to learn what are the things in our lives, in our minds, that benefit us, and what are the things that are harmful, and to take what is beneficial and to nurture it, to help it to be developed, and what is harmful, to let that go, to grow beyond that. This is a very wonderful and unique situation. And we are all greatly benefited by the good efforts and intentions of those around us, because we don't have to look very far outside the boundaries of the monastery to see that a lot of people in the world are not spending their days trying to cultivate the wholesome and let go of the unwholesome. You know, the world is full of agitation and contention, acquisitiveness. The other day I was reading this talk of Lumpur Sumedho's at the daily reading, and it was from about 30 years ago, and during the time of the arms race and the kind of nuclear tension between the Soviet Union and the USA, and Lumpur was encouraging the need for wisdom in the world because of such degrees of tension and conflict. And 30 years have gone by, and even though there isn't the obvious threat of nuclear war that was in the air back in the early 80s, still human beings managed to be in conflict with each other. Yeah. But, everywhere we look around the world, there's civil strife, there's the difficulties in the Ukraine, the Russian takeover of the Crimea, the internal strife in Iraq, Afghanistan, through Africa, countries around the Middle East, endless insurgencies and difficulties. strife, Scotland murmuring to secede from the UK. What we'll call ourselves, it will be the Disunited Kingdom, maybe the DK. After that, I have to come up with, I'm sure the tabloids will be running competitions to see who can come up with the right name. Maybe the Isle of Wight will secede, and then the Shetlands and the Hebrides will go their own way. Kent will declare independence. Well, this is the nature of the world, to for human beings to get into conflict and to be competing for resources, to be arguing, fighting against each other because of different ideologies or the desire for power, for the control of different territories. This is the way that things are in the world. If we look at the scriptures and the stories of things in the time of the Buddha, it really hasn't changed very much. You have the Koliyans and the Vangsans and the Magadans and the Vajians and the striving for power, looking to see who's going to be the dominant local force, who's taking over whose territory, which is the most powerful monarch or oligarchy. So the need for wisdom in the world is as strong as it ever was. As I said, there's not so much the threat of imminent nuclear destruction as there was 30 years ago, but still, all around us and within society, there are stresses and strains, you know, within Thailand, within the UK, within the Middle East, Africa, America, all around the world. If we just listen to the news and we read all the reports, we can create a tremendous tension within ourselves, a sense of anxiety and concern, a fearfulness, which is understandable. We have a compassionate nature as human beings, and so we care about the welfare of other people, other beings around the planet. And so it is distressing to hear, to read of such degrees of conflict. But the way of the Buddha is not, it doesn't just encourage us to, doesn't encourage us at all to create more suffering about the suffering that is there, but rather to do what we can within our own life and in the world to, create an alternative, to be a force for harmony within ourselves, to be a force for harmony in the world around us. When we look at our minds, we have this opportunity through this 3 months of the winter retreat. We've been able to have a lot of time for formal practice, to engage in meditation. And we can see where the causes of conflict lie just by watching our own minds. When we look around the world and we think, oh, why are people fighting? Why do they cause so much stress and difficulty for each other? Why can't they get along? But then we look into our own minds. We look at our own internal world and look at our own loves and hates, our own fears and desires, our own habits and preferences. And there it all is. That's the template for human struggle and human conflict. It is right here within us. We can see how it works. We can see how tension and difficulty, stress and conflict gets caused. And when we watch our own minds, we see how it's through the simple attachment, the investing in the desire for what we like, wanting to own it and hold it, keep it, wanting to get rid of and get away from what we dislike, what we disapprove of. It's not complicated, it's not strange or remote. The more that we can understand the nature of conflict, the more we can understand the way that desire and fear and aversion, the feeling of wanting to protect my territory, my patch, my things, my space, the more we can see that within ourselves, the more we can understand that, then the more that enables us to understand those urges, those compulsions in others, and the more that we're able to resolve those within ourselves, then the more that we can bring that same kind of capacity for resolution into the world around us. We're learning how to say settle our differences through discussion, through understanding, through being able to listen to each other, and through a commitment to sila, to action and speech that is noble, that is respectful, that takes into account the harmfulness that comes from acting in ways that are selfish or violent or greedy, aggressive. One of the things of living in community, all of us who've been here, whether it's for a long time or a short time, medium length of time, one thing that we notice, probably even if we're here for a day, is that in a monastery, just like every place, you have a very, very wide variety of different characters. We have many, many different nationalities here, probably 15 or 20, 25 different nationalities. We have different personalities, introverts, extroverts, intellectuals, artistic types, energetic types, quiet types. Academic types, expressive, artistic types, all different sorts. And what enables us to get along is a common commitment to the precepts. But it doesn't mean to say that we always agree. Now, the keeping the precepts isn't just a matter of sort of controlling our behavior, but it helps through the respect for the precepts and restraining our conduct. It helps us to really respect and accommodate each other, so that when we live together, we're not just sort of believing in our judgments of I approve of this person, I don't like that person, I disapprove of this, I like that. And we're not just sort of bottling up our own attitudes and keeping within the bounds of the precepts just through sort of a forced self-control. That's not really sila. Sila is also it's not just the controlling the behavior, but it's also to do with the attitude that we have. And what this means essentially is that even though I might not agree with your opinion, even though I might not like your point of view, I might see things very, very differently. I fully respect your right to have a different opinion. As I think it was Voltaire put it, I might disagree violently with your opinion, but I will defend to the death your right to express it, to hold on to it. So that even though you might disagree with someone, you might not like the way they think or what their attitude is, it's a respect for other people to see things differently. That we don't just judge everybody according to our own point of view, our own perspective, but we are able to see, oh yeah, well, they have a different outlook. they see things differently. And what makes my point of view the right one? Just because I see it this way, what makes that correct? And what makes other people wrong? So this is the in a way the fundamental principle of how to live as Kalyanamitta, as spiritual friends, and how to live in a relationship of harmony, So it's not just controlling the behavior and sort of just zipping the mouth shut, but it's that change of heart that within us, that attitude that says, you have a perfect right to see things completely different from the way that I do. Yeah? I am English, or you maybe are Sri Lankan, or French, or German, Spanish, or Thai. I'm a man, you're a woman. I'm older, you're younger. So of course we see things in different ways. And so this capacity to not just judge everybody according to our own perspective and assume that because I think it must, you know, it's therefore right, but to be able to say make space for the views, the attitudes, the experience of others, this is what enables us to really get along and to flourish as a spiritual community. And the more that we can get to know our mind, then the more we're able to do that. Because in a sense, what we're doing at the root is we're learning to recognize all those different attributes of our own mind. You know, within our own mind, we have many different strands of activity and attitude as well. You know, within our own minds, we have the diligent meditator. We have, you know, the greedy, reactive three-year-old. We have the thoughtful intellectual. We have the emotionally unstable. We have all, you know, many, many different characters and aspects of our own nature. As I often like to describe it, we have an inner committee with many, many different characters. So that the more that within our own practice we're able to listen to all the different members of our own inner committee, from the diligent meditator and the noble spiritual seeker, you know, to the reactive and whining three-year-old, you know, I don't want it, it's not fair, you can't make me, what about me? Well, I think, actually, that the Buddha says. So we learn to listen to all those voices, to listen to the different aspects of our own nature, and similarly, to treat them with respect, to listen to all the different voices around the table in the committee room, and to let wisdom be the chair of the committee. Satipanya, mindfulness and wisdom. Let that be the chair of the committee that receives all the voices and then treats them with respect. Because as soon as any of the voices around our own inner committee table, as soon as we reject them or judge them or say, well, I want to listen to you, but you better shut up and you don't have a vote and you're the important one. You know, I like you. I don't like the other one. Then you have chaos. You have conflict. You have stress and difficulty. So, in our practice, in developing our spiritual lives, it's essential that we learn to listen to all those different aspects of our nature. You know, when you haven't eaten for a day, and then you come into the sala, and there's the smell of breakfast materials, as a very profound one-pointedness, the kind of the vigor with which the feet fly across the floor of the sala, and all of the rest of the universe disappears. There's the hyenas gathering around the wildebeest. You know, whoomph. But there's a very clear one-pointedness. Breakfast. And that's quite natural. So in that time of day and a hungry body, then that's the dominant voice in the committee is, eat now, me, back off. But that's natural. It's just the language of the body and the instinctual system operating. Through these many hours of meditation, we listen to the different voices and we learn to respect them all. The wise, noble, good-hearted, unselfish voices, the whining, complaining, petulant three-year-old, the clear-headed rationalist, the emotional reactor. We listen to them. Let satipanya, mindfulness and wisdom, receive all those voices. And then through that wisdom, then we learn to integrate the different voices, the different impulses, the different aspects of our nature that are there. The instinctual ones, the wise ones, the reactive ones, the experienced ones, the rational ones, the irrational ones. And through that integration, through satipanya, then we learn how to respond and to guide our actions in the way of what is wholesome and let go of what is unwholesome. And the more we can do that within ourselves, then the more we're able to do that in community. We're able to, say, listen to the people of different nationalities, different genders, different ages, different experience. It's a wonderful and marvelous thing when living in community and you're talking with other people and discussing what people are experiencing in meditation, different questions people have about their practice. It's astonishing, amazing, the variety of different say experiences that people have. Say one person never experienced any kind of concentration whatsoever, but yet their mind is quite lively and reflective and thoughtful, creative. And they're able to, say, develop a lot of wisdom, but they have no capacity for focusing on the breathing at all. Somebody else might have a continuous stream of inner visions. As soon as they close their eyes, it's just like one kind of set of patterns and images and forms after another, after another, after another. Somebody else never sees anything except the back of their eyelids. No capacity for inner vision at all. Some people have a very strong capacity to concentrate, just close their eyes, and they say, "Well, yes, I bring my mind to the breath, and it sits there for an hour or two, and then what do I do after that?" And then the person sitting next to them sort of looks around in total amazement. What? You can just put your attention on the breath and it just stays there for a couple of hours? What? I can't even find my breath. I don't even think I'm breathing. I've been meditating for 5 years and I've only ever noticed one inhalation. There's a marvelous, incredible variety of experiences and different perceptions. Different attitudes and different backgrounds that we all have. Oh, the degree to which we are able to listen respectfully and to say attune to the perspectives of everybody that we live with, everybody we encounter. That that capacity to attune is directly related to the quality of peacefulness and contentment within us. That in us which is unbiased, but which is receptive, able to, say, accommodate and take into account all different perspectives, different people's characters, personalities, stories, different attitudes. The more that the heart is able to do that and to live in and to operate in a way which is unbiased, which isn't favoring one over another, or thinking, this person is better than that one, or I like this type, but I don't like that type. But rather, to be able to say, oh, well, that's interesting, that's different, oh, that's good too. Oh, I never saw the world like that, like she does or he does. Oh, that's good too. To the degree that the heart can accommodate and respect the perspectives of others, whether they're old or young, whether they're a few years old or many years old, whatever gender or nationality, or whatever their background might be, that quality of acceptance and receptivity is the very root of contentment, the very root of sukha, of happiness and ease. And when there is that quality of contentment, that sense of being at ease with all conditions, that directly supports the development of samadhi. And the presence of samadhi then directly supports the development of insight. Now the degree to which we can accommodate and live at peace with people here in the community, and also communicates itself around the world, that we might think that, oh, we live in our own little kind of enclave, our own little patch, and we can feel separated off from the world at large. But the world is very connected. People know of this place. People visit this place. Many, hundreds of people visit this place. And what happens here and how the community is here, say that has its effect in direct and indirect ways around the world. So that in terms of bringing wisdom into the world, we might not feel like we're doing a lot to say, settle the strife in Syria or in Afghanistan or in Crimea or South America, you know, all the different trouble spots around the world. But my experience is that people pay attention. People know of a place like this. And everyone of us who lives here, we are Amaravati. You are Amaravati. The place wouldn't exist if each one of us wasn't here. It would just be a collection of buildings parked on a corner of Harpurchur. So each of us contributes to what this place is. And each of us contributes to the spirit of what this place brings into the world and what it embodies and what it is a resource for others, how it exists as a resource for people around the world. And it's kind of amazing when nowadays people are so connected that and they're listening to recorded Dhamma talks, podcasts, and seeing articles that they're literally all over the planet. You get communications from people who are they commuting to work in Caracas, listening to Dhamma talks from Amaravati on a daily basis, or people in Dar es Salaam or Ulaanbaatar, literally Beijing. If you look at the activity of or interest in the Amaravati website, or our sort of Forest Sangha websites, that Delhi is a hotspot, Beijing is a hotspot. There's whole clusters of people in China for whom this is a really important place. Who'd have thought? Brazil. The Brazilian, the downloading of Dhamma talks is, I think they've been overtaken, I think they've overtaken the Italians now, there's a massive amount of interest in Dhamma and recordings and literature from our community in Brazil. Now, how many of you here at Amaravati, sitting through the middle of an afternoon sitting, negotiating with your defilements, thinking, I'm really helping a bunch of people in Rio de Janeiro right now? I mean... there's some people in Beijing that I'm really contributing positively to the lives of. It doesn't cross our mind, does it? But that's the fact. That what we do here, how we live here, how you work with your mind, how you deal with the distracted thoughts in this moment. The very fact that how many of us, 50, 60, 70 people gathered this evening? The fact that a few dozen people of us gather together on a Sunday night to meditate, listen to the Dhamma, to keep the lunar observance, this has its effect upon people all over the planet. And it is encouraging, empowering, liberating. I feel very, very strongly this is a extremely positive contribution to world peace, to the well-being of the planet. And even though that might seem a bit harebrained or a bit over-optimistic, come on, it doesn't have that much of an effect, or, you know, really, I mean, let's be sensible. But I encourage all of us to just take a step back from our usual view about going through a day, passing a day here at Amaravati, concerned with your duties in the community as a senior nun or senior monk, or in the office or the kitchen or around the grounds, or the gardens, or as a visitor. Well, I'm not really contributing that much. I mean, well, maybe some of the others, you know, the expert meditators or the old timers or the people who really matter, but not me. I don't really matter. I don't make that much of a difference. How could I? But I really encourage us to step back from those habitual judgments and to recognize that without each and every one of us, Amaravati wouldn't exist. Yeah. The monastery is the people, it's not the buildings. The monastery is the people, and the people is you. So even though you might think, well, that's a bit over the top, Ajahn Amaro is kind of overdoing it again. He's overstating it. But to just step back from that and just to consider, yeah, well, even if it's just a tiny little bit, that my interest, my effort, even though I might say that it's very, judge it as being very small, very minimal, you know, the efforts that I make to just live according to the sila, to restrain my urges, to live in a contained and renunciate form, that contributes to the harmony of the monastery. That contributes to this place being here. My interest in developing the Buddha's path, my interest in training this life, steering the energies of this life towards wisdom, towards unselfishness, towards liberation, that contributes to the place, that contributes to the spirit of what is here, and contributes and supports the efforts of others. Whether we acknowledge it or not, I would suggest that that's the case. Your efforts, your commitment supports me and is inspiring and encouraging to me. We all help each other. We all contribute to each other's lives in that way. And then the existence of places like this have an effect, have their impact in the world. It's very striking. I've been mentioning it a few times recently, but it's really striking to me now how much Buddhist meditation is becoming a mainstream item in the West. 30 years ago, we were very much a weird, lunatic fringe outfit. You know, strange people walking around in brown sheets, like white ghosts with shaven heads. Definitely a very weird case, and strange items. Now, somebody gave me a copy of Time magazine with mindfulness meditation on the front cover. You get mindfulness meditation prescribed on the National Health Service. The recognition of this as being, you know, a very useful, helpful, beneficial commodity is getting more and more widespread. It's becoming very, very normal. Well, there is a tremendous need for wisdom in the world. There's a tremendous benefit and blessings that that come from living this life. But it's also important not to just sort of take that in a personal way. Like, oh, I've got to sustain the wisdom in the world, it's up to me. Or like, oh, look at me, I'm a source of wisdom in the world. Yeah, whoopee, look at me. It, that, the say, the grasping of that side of things by the habits of self-view, either in an inflated way or in a stressful way, that doesn't really help. Yeah, the genuine and sort of full development of wisdom really comes through letting go of self-view, as is said over and over again, and that we are the more that we can say base a practice on an abandonment, letting go of self-view, then the more completely and fully it can be actualized. That the path is fulfilled. So if we really want to help the world, we really want to be a benefit to the world, you know, if we really love the world completely, then we let go of it. We let go of the world, we let go of this life, we let go of self and other. And the practice of meditation, particularly insight meditation, is the most direct and effective method for that. If we take a sort of superficial or mechanistic view, I've got to help the world. I've got to be like this, and I shouldn't be like that. You know, even though those are reasonable or understandable attitudes, I want to be a better person. I should be more wholesome and kind and unselfish. And I should be more generous, more compassionate. I should be less greedy and aggressive. You know, those are wholesome intentions, but if they're still based on self-view, on me trying to be something, me trying to get rid of my problems and defilements, and me trying to become good and wise and holy, then it's always going to be wide of the mark. That our spiritual potential is fulfilled mostly through and taking those wholesome intentions, but also freeing them from the habits of I and me and mine, of self-creation. So if we really love the world, then we let go of it completely. If we really want to bring this the potential of this life to its fulfillment, then we let go of our life. We let go of, the focusing on I and me and mine. And this is, the moment-by-moment application of insight. Or when we take our life and try to sort of purify it or make it better, it's rather like the well-known story out of the Zen tradition of the sixth Zen patriarch Huineng, who was an illiterate lad from the south of China, and he the story goes that when he was he came from a very poor family. His father had died, and he would gather firewood and sell it in the marketplace to make a few pennies, and that would support him and his mother. And one day he heard somebody reciting a verse of the Vajra Sutra in the market, and he was so struck by this. And it was a verse that said, one should give rise to the thought that is not based on anything. Give rise to the mind. Which is not based on anything. He heard this phrase from the Vajra Sutra and immediately had this profound insight and asked the person, "Where does that come from? What do those words mean?" Was very struck by the wisdom and the power of that verse. And they said, "Oh, these are verses from the Vajra Sutra. I learned them from the fifth patriarch who lives up in the north." And so Huineng immediately formed the idea that he wanted to go and travel to visit this great master. And so, but he was very poor, and so fortunately somebody was ready to support his efforts and gave a donation for the family, to a bunch of silver to support his mother, and so Huineng could go off. And he was like a teenager at this time, 16, 17 years old. He took off on his own to the north of China to go to the monastery of the fifth patriarch. When he got there, he went to work in the monastery kitchen. And to cut a long story short, there was the fifth patriarch saw that his life was coming to an end, and he said, "Well, it's time for me to appoint a successor. I'm getting old. I need to have someone who can take over being the leader of the community and to fulfill the role of the patriarch. So we'll have a competition. So I will ask everybody to write an inspired verse, and the person who writes the verse that's most impressive or most insightful, then I'll pass on the bowl and robe." Traditionally, they're saying the bowl and the robe of the Buddha, and appoint them as the next patriarch. And so there was the second monk in the assembly. I think his name was Shen Hui. Was very much the sort of leading scholar and the main acharya in the community. So everyone assumed that he would come up with an inspired verse. But he also was unsure of his own insight. He knew he was an expert. He could recite all kinds of teachings. He could quote sutras, but he didn't really think he was that enlightened. So he wasn't sure whether any verse that he came up with was going to be worthy of the master's approval or not. So what he did was he snuck out in the night, and then he wrote this. He came up with a verse and wrote it on the wall in one of the corridors that was being decorated. He sort of snuck out and got a pot of paint and wrote it on the wall. And so he thought, okay, well, see what the master says. And if he approves it, then I'll claim it as my own. If he disapproves it, I'll just keep quiet. So he wrote this verse, and the verse went: "The body is like a Bodhi tree. The mind is like a bright mirror. Every day we wipe it clean, so that no dust will alight." So then he wrote this up on the wall, and then the master came along. You know, there was all this commotion going on, or somebody's written a verse up on the wall in the corridor. And so the fifth patriarch came along and said, "Oh, yeah, very good, very good, very good. Whoever wrote this certainly has some insight." And then his disciple Shen Hui said, "Well, actually, Venerable Sir, it was I." He said, "Oh, yeah, very good." So he approved of it, but he didn't actually kind of name him the next patriarch then and there. But he said, "Well, this is a very good verse, and so I encourage people to memorize this, and it'll be something very helpful." So then, meanwhile, Huineng was sort of working down in the kitchen, sort of pounding rice, and he couldn't read, so he wasn't able to read this verse for himself. But down in the kitchen, somebody was reciting this verse: that the body is like a Bodhi tree, the mind is like a bright mirror, every day we should wipe it clean so that no dust will alight. And Huineng said, "What's that you're reciting?" And they said, "Oh, it's this verse that Shen Hui wrote, and the master told everyone to learn it, and so they should recite it because it's a very useful Dharma teaching." And Huineng thought, "Well, that's not very impressive to me." And so anyway, he thought, "Well, that's not a very impressive verse, and I think that he's missing the point, really." So he asked, he'd made friends with this layman who was also staying in the monastery, and said, "Show me where this verse is written." So they went up to this corridor where the verse was painted on the wall. And so he said, "Okay, if you can find a pot of paint, I'd like you to write a verse for me. I think I can do better than this. But I can't write. I can't read. I can't write. So if you could do the writing for me, I'd be grateful." So then the fellow said, "Well, obviously this kid is confident. seems to have an idea. He knows what he's talking about. Let's try this out and see what happens. So then he asked him to write this sort of companion verse up on the wall next to the original one, and the companion verse, the sort of new improved one from Huineng, was the body is not a Bodhi tree, in the mind there is no mirror. From the very beginning, there has never been a single thing. Where could the dust alight? The body is not a Bodhi tree. In the mind, there is no mirror. From the very beginning, there has never been a single thing. Where could the dust alight? And so this layman who wrote this up, well, kind of weird verse, but all right, I'll write it up. He wrote that up on the wall, and then the next day, of course, there's a bit of a commotion. A gang of people gathered in the corridor, mumble, 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 discussing this verse. Yeah. And then the fifth patriarch, you know, came along and took one look and went, huh. Took his shoe off and scrubbed it out, you know, sort of smudged it over and then stomped off. So it seemed like he didn't approve of it. But it seems like he asked around a bit and he had an idea of where the verse had come from, and he popped down to the kitchens and in a subtle way invited Huineng to drop round his rooms sometime and when Huineng came kind of to see him, he said, well, that verse you wrote is certainly the verse of the words of a patriarch. So, you know, I want to name you as my successor. However, you're a layman and you're illiterate and you're a southern barbarian. So, you know, the people here are not going to accept you as being their leader. And so I want to name you as my successor, but you better leave quickly because there'll be a lot of jealous people and they'll give you trouble. So then it was kind of, you know, it was a long story, but Huineng then went into hiding for 16 years and lived with a bunch of hunters off in the mountains till finally he emerged and was acknowledged as a great teacher. But the reason why I tell the story is because of this, the kind of contrast between these two verses. So whereas the first verse is saying, you know, the mind is like a mirror that the dust lands on and we must keep it clean, you know, dust it, wipe it, and keep it clean every day. That's in a sense the worldly approach to practice. I've got to become a better person. I should have more pure thoughts. I should get rid of my defilements. I should be kind and generous and wise. And I should, let go of my selfishness and greed and jealousy and opinionated views. That there's a person here who has these qualities, who needs to get more good qualities to get rid of unwholesome qualities, and that's in a sense on a worldly plane that seems quite reasonable. But just as the patriarch recognized, well, yeah, it's worthy on a worldly level, but it's not the whole story. Right? It doesn't really cut deeply enough. And it seems that the fifth patriarch had scrubbed out that verse because he immediately saw that it was extremely wise, and that it was went far beyond the first verse in wisdom. But also that whoever had inscribed that was going to be receiving a lot of jealousy and aggression and aversion from others who were. Didn't think them worthy or appropriate, and so that the verse of Huineng, where he says, the body is not a Bodhi tree, the mind there is no mirror. From the very beginning, there has never been a single thing. Where could the dust alight? So this is pointing to the quality of wisdom itself, that it has no form. The fundamental nature of mind has no form. It's not a tree. It's not a mirror. There's no thing for the dust of the world to land on. There's no landing place for the conditions of sight, sound, smell, taste, touch, thought and feeling and mood. There's no place for them to land. That unsupportedness, the lack of a landing place, that's the true quality of the empty mind, the true quality of wisdom, that which can receive and accommodate all things, without a concept of a person, an individual, a me that's got these attributes, a me who's got to get more of this, or me who's got to get rid of that. It's an expression of that selfless quality of wisdom. There is this unborn, unoriginated, uncreated. That is the true nature of mind, the mind in its fundamental character, unborn, unoriginated, uncreated, unformed. Whereas in the other verse in the Udana that comes very close to that, so the Buddha says there is this sphere of being where there is no sun, no moon, no stars, no this world, no other world, no coming, no going, no standing still. And in this realm, this sphere of being, it has no basis, no dependence, no support. Only this is the end of suffering. So Huineng's verse is reflecting that same kind of no basis, no development, no support, and no coming, no going, no standing still. And that's where we find the true resolution of practice, the true fulfillment of the path. It's not in being a person who's got to be more like this and got to be less like that, but in recognizing that the person arises and passes away, that the feelings of I and me and mine arise and pass away, and they are not self. Just like in the, even though Ajahn Chah had read some of the teachings actually of Huineng, Ajahn Buddhadasa translated them into Thai. He was very fond of these teachings and was very impressed by them. But he also had been speaking in the same terms himself for many years. And when he gave his last advice to Lumpur Sumato just before his health collapsed in 1981, he sent a little letter to Lumpur Sumato at Chithurst saying, whenever you have feelings of love or hate for anything whatsoever, these will be your aids and partners in building paramita. The Buddha Dharma is not to be found in moving forwards, nor in moving backwards, nor in standing still. This Sumato is your place of non-abiding. So, that was sort of Lumpur's final advice to, okay, Sumato, now. he intuited his health was about to collapse, that he was not going to be able to teach much longer. So, and there was Ajahn Sumato just starting up this new community, this whole adventure off in the West, and you'd think, you know, the teacher would give a list of, well, do this and this and this, and don't do that, and don't do that, and don't do that, and always remember to do this, and if you want to respect the teaching, you should always do that. And long list of do's and don'ts, but there was none of that. So what was his essential advice to his sort of chief disciple establishing Dhamma in the West? The Buddha Dharma is not to be found in moving forwards, nor in moving backwards, nor in standing still. That's the key advice. So to the thinking mind, it's kind of frustrating. It's like, but what am I supposed to do? Well, that's the worldly attitude. Our worldly conditioned attitude is always sort of looking for an explanation or a list. But in a sense, it's up to us to discover that root of Dhamma, which is our own nature, to let go of time and place and self, to to abide in that place of non-abiding, where there's no coming, no going, no standing still, where there's no place for the dust to alight, which is frustrating or confusing to the habits of self-view, but when that is those habits are let go of, in that letting go of the habits of self-creation, not seeing things in terms of me and mine, I, we find that place where the dust cannot alight, where there is no Bodhi tree, no mirror, no place for anything to land. There's a spaciousness, a receptivity, and an attunement. So even though these kind of ways of speaking can sound a bit sort of spacey or intangible, a bit remote, the effect of developing that attitude, letting the heart abide in that place which is no place, neither coming nor going nor standing still. It doesn't mean that we're sort of just lost in the middle of the traffic, kind of like a balloon that's lost its string, like a kite carried away on the wind. Rather, it means we find ourselves fully attuned, able to attune to this situation, this particular task, this person, this conversation, this moment. We find ourselves able to fit in and to work with the endlessly complex changing conditions of every time, place, and situation, so that enables our heart to be completely unbiased and responsive, able to attune itself to all circumstance. So I offer these thoughts for consideration this evening. As we have period of group formal practice through to the end of the retreat, then as we did at the beginning in January, we'll keep the meditation routine going. So today's the moon night, but we'll have morning puja tomorrow, morning meditation puja as usual, 5 o'clock. So those of you who wish to stay up to midnight are more than welcome to. Those of you who wish to retire can also do. And we'll carry on with the meditation routine through till the end of the week. Now, those of you who are thinking, oh, Ajahn Amaro, he's a real slave driver. How can he demand such a effort from us? Can't we have a day off? But I would encourage you to watch those thoughts. Because part of me can also say, this is actually a pretty light routine. Speaking of ancient, not even so ancient China, I was a number of years ago, there was in one of the early editions of Vajra Bodhi Seed, this Buddhist magazine out of Master Hua's community, they reprinted the opening Dhamma talk from this 70-day sesshin at Gaomin Monastery in China. And there's this very famously ferocious acharya there, great master Lai Guo, and it was the most marvelous opening talk for a retreat. It's not uncommon for people to die during retreats at Gaomin Monastery. Yeah, the standards here are extremely rigorous. Morning meditation begins at 3 o'clock and finishes at midnight every day. No one will leave the meditation hall for any reason whatsoever during a period of formal sitting. If you have an emergency and you need to go to the toilet, you will be beaten several times. by the Dhammacharya with the holy wooden truncheon. And it's not uncommon for people to receive broken bones or severe injuries during these beatings, but that's to be expected. Yeah. If you have to go to the toilet, just simply discharge yourself into the sitting mat and deal with it later. If you happen to die during the course of the retreat, we do not pause the retreat to have such things as a rebirth ceremony and funerals. Your body will merely be thrown underneath the sitting platform, and the rebirth ceremonies will be taken care of once the retreat is over. So just to give you a bit of a context, you know, that it's really a pretty mild standard that we have here. There's no beatings. And if you do happen to die, we can have a funeral. You know. We won't have to wait till the end of the month till we have the funeral. So consider this very gentle and easy treatment that you're all receiving.